Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik Palmgren. You are listening to Red Eyes Radio. We go out worldwide at redeyescreations.com and also redeyesmembers.com. We cover a lot on conspiracy, geopolitics, falsified history, and many other unknown aspects, but we also strive to continue to go into new territory, cover new aspects, and highlight topics seldomly discussed on other outlets and channels to bring some balance and sound perspective to an extremely unbalanced and confusion-ridden world. In these times of war on human nature and war on reality, it's increasingly important to aid in the disillusion process as we discover the lies and scientific method behind social engineering, how to control and subjugate mankind to ideas and ideologies that are false and downright detrimental to all of us that want to live in harmony with not only ourselves, but our families, our friends, our neighbors, our nation, and the world, as opposed to the chaos-ridden new world order that the global elite are constructing for us as a trap of de-evolution and de-civilization. So, important stuff. If you're new to the program, please take some time to look at our archives and tune in to some of our other programs. We have over a year of shows available for free without commercial interruptions and blinking website banners and everything else. We do have our entire archives, our full broadcast, available at redeyesmembers.com, so please take a look there as well. Today we're talking with Joseph Atwill. He is an independent scholar who has set the world of New Testament scholarship in a new direction. His book, Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus, Atwill outlined the series of events in Jesus' ministry that parallels with the events of the battle campaign of Titus Flavius, as recorded by Josephus Flavius in War of the Jews. Numerous scholars had noticed the parallels between the Gospels and Josephus' work before, but Atwill is the first to notice that all the parallels takes place in exact sequence and has drawn a revolutionary conclusion because of this. Our topic today is that of the work that has led Joseph to discover a correlation between the Gospels and Shakespeare's work, but a complete reversal of the typology found therein. We'll discuss the real identity of Shakespeare, why the folios were written, what their purpose is, also discuss the characters and the events that take place in them. But also, more importantly, the bigger picture, how this ties into an ancient and historical battle between religions, peoples, tribes, and ideologies, and how this has been part in the tactic of the deliberate and vengeful destruction of the West and the European. A very interesting discussion coming up with Joseph Atwill. Stay with us. Welcome back, Joseph. Great talking with you again. Thanks for coming on once more to Red Eyes Radio. It's always a delight speaking with you. Hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing very well, and thank you for having me, Henry.
We have a lot on our plate today. A really interesting show, I think, ahead of us here, and a lot of different strands, I guess pun intended, to tie this in together here. But let's talk a little bit first. Last time you were with us, we talked, of course, about Caesar's Messiah, the observation of the typology and everything else that you've been studying. Now you've moved over to Shakespeare, another topic that we've talked about recently on the show as well. How did you go from one to the other, Joseph? Tell us about that.
Well, in fact, it's a transition that is completely logical and guided by the authors themselves. If you understand the Gospels, if you understand the story of Jesus as a kind of prefiguration and a mockery of the Roman Jewish War, then when you come to Shakespeare, you have the correct interpretive framework to make sense of the plays. In other words, the author of the Shakespearean literature was very familiar with the typology in the Gospels and, in fact, wrote her literature. The author of the Shakespearean stuff was a woman, wrote her literature as a reversal of what the Romans had done with the Gospels. And if you are familiar with the Gospels typology, then suddenly all of the Shakespearean plays, which are so boring and incomprehensible, become kind of funny and very easy to understand. I read Titus Andronicus, and the reason that I actually was interested in that play is because the character Titus obviously is the name kind of evokes the character who was in back of the Gospels, Titus Flavius.
Yeah.
But moreover, Andronicus, this caught my attention. I wasn't really into Shakespeare, but there was something about the title. Well, it was very specific. What brought me into it was the fact that the Andronici had sacked the Temple of Jerusalem. And so that then left the Andronici and Titus Flavius as among the few groups that have ever done that. And I was wondering if the author was making some kind of a comment about the Flavians. I had no idea what sort of a comment, but that's what brought me in to try to read the play, which is just this miserable and incomprehensible bloodbath with limbs flying off and beheadings and cannibalism, and it's kind of like the Gospels actually. But so anyway, I read it, and once I got into it, I could see what the author was doing. They were simply mocking what the Romans had done. And at the end of Titus Andronicus, you have this new Titus having a cannibal feast, which is obviously a parallel to the Last Supper in the Gospels, which is a cannibal joke. But here, instead of the people eating the human flesh being the Jewish royal family, the Maccabees being mocked, it's the Gentile royal families. And so this really is the fact. If you understand that, you can just simply understand the entire Shakespearean literature. It just is a reversing of the typology in the Gospels. It's just done from a Jewish perspective. One of the things that simply shocked me when I was reading it, and it sort of gave me the energy to continue with the play, is it's sort of at the beginning of a play, I think maybe Act 3, Titus Andronicus is talking with his brother, and he asks him what he's doing, and his brother, whose name is Marcus, which is a typologic name linking to Titus's brother Domitian, but it's too complicated for me to explain at this point. But anyway, so Titus Andronicus says, "What are you doing?" And Marcus says, "I've just killed a fly." And Titus Andronicus he goes, "What are you doing?" You know, it says, "It doesn't become the brother of Titus to kill a fly." So this was made it just completely transparent to me that the play is a comment of some kind on the Flavians, because in fact, if you're classically trained, you'll know that Suetonius had described Domitian's proclivity for a single act. The thing he loved most to do was to kill flies. He loved to be by himself, catch flies, and then stab them with a stylus. And so there was actually a joke that Suetonius recorded, which when someone asked if there was anyone in there with Domitian, Crispus made the witty reply, "Not even a fly." So this was a kind of a well-known patrician humor concerning Domitian, which the character in Titus Andronicus is commenting on. And so then the very next play I read, which just because in the anthology I had, it had Macbeth. And here I was quite alert for, the kind of Jewish subtext. And so when we came to the very beginning of the play, you have a description of Macbeth, and they're describing what a great warrior he is. And they have all of this sewing imagery in Macbeth, which no one has ever made any sense out of. And the passage they're talking about him, and I'm doing this from memory, but the sure. passage, they go, Macbeth was such a mighty warrior. He seamed his opponent and then unseamed him, so they have this seamstress imagery or seamster imagery, that's being used as kind of a military, adjective. And then the next line is, "Oh, noble Macbeth, well does he deserve his name." Well, if you know Hebrew, you know that Macbeth means seamster. So this, these are sort of the subtext, the Jewish comic subtext, which frames the plots so you kind of can identify the characters and know who's the bad guy and who's the good guy. And you come to completely different understandings of the plays. You get to see, you know, what that Romeo and Juliet is just a big cannibal joke and stuff like that. So in my new book, Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, I go through a bunch of plays and I show how they operate basically symbolically, so you can, you know, understand the storyline. And I show who the author was, this woman named Amelia Bassano.
Yeah.
And so Bassano is just this very interesting character. She's really the only person among a handful who could have been the author of the Shakespearean literature, because if you go through the literature, you can see all of this different language. The person is quite a linguist. There is a Latin and French and Italian. There's an enormous amount of Italian sort of references. And there's also, as I mentioned, some Hebrew puns. And so Amelia Bassano, her family were Jews that Henry VIII brought to England to improve his court music. They were instrument makers and they were also musicians. And so he brought this family, there was five brothers, and Amelia was the daughter of the eldest brother, Baptista. The family was Jewish. They, of course, had converted to Christianity, which was legally mandated
right
at this time, but in fact practiced Judaism in secret. And one of her cousins, her husband, was found in a secret synagogue and racked, tortured and killed. And so Amelia knew, you know, very well what the consequences was for overt practice of Judaism. And instead, she produced this literature, which was, I imagine, you know, something that would have had a kind of emotional stabilizing effect in her life, to be able to have some sort of response, which couldn't be given in the open. Amelia Bassano, she was a language tutor. And since her family had come from the area around Venice, she knew all of this information. I suspect she traveled there, but I have no evidence of that. But since she was a language tutor and her family would have probably been the generation before her were native Italian speakers, she grew up, of course, speaking English. So she had this background. And so the Shakespearean literature just came naturally out of her mind. And so once you've sort of identified the actual symbolic framework of the literature, and, you know, you can focus in on who could have possibly produced this, she pops right up. And then, in fact, she also wrote a poem called Salve Deus Rex Juordum, which means Hail God, King of the Jews, which is a macabre poem about eating the flesh of Jesus. Can't recommend it on any level, but in the play, you know, you get to see a lot of the Shakespearean language, and she has a pun on the name of Will, which is linked into the sonnets, which is an autobiographical storyline, basically, that she comes up with. It's a little complicated. But I was able to see that the pun that she was using on "His will be done" in Salve Deus was directly related to the will pun that she had created in the sonnet. So that was actually the moment I was sure that she was the writer. There's a lot of other characterizations. the story about Ephesus, the Comedy of Errors, the person who represents Josephus, the author of the Gospels, so-called. You know, she in the Comedy of Errors, you have at the end of it, you have a scene where this abbess has the character, and she says, you know, I have to administer all of these things to revive him. She's basically, he's just linking typologically to Josephus. And then she names herself. She says, my name is Amelia. So, you know, this was how she saw herself, basically, as, you know, just this a character who was in real life, who was producing literature that was reversing the typology that the Gospels had done. And, you know, this seems far-fetched, but, you know, you have to kind of go back to the first century to sort of start to make sense out of all this. The big problem that the Flavians were facing was one of scriptural interpretation. The Jews were looking into their literature and seeing these messianic prophecies, and that was what propelled them to rebel. This was recorded by the Roman historians. Josephus specifically stated that what most propelled and drove the Jews to rebel were these messianic prophecies. In other words, were the promise of a Christ, someone that would come and lead them militarily. And this would be like a David character in the Old Testament, right? So they'd have the power of God, and you'd be able to fight against the Romans. Now, one of the odd criticisms that Caesar's Messiah gets is people say, well, why would they do this since they'd already crushed the Jews, right? They had this enormous battle, and they destroyed them. So there's no reason for them to worry about this messianic movement. Well,
not really.
This isn't a really very alert understanding of history, because if you think of the Gospels being written, you know, in 80 going on to say 100 in this period where they were producing them, the whole Roman Empire was winding up for what became known as first the Bard Dorma rebellion in like 115, and then the Bar Kokhba rebellion in 133. And these rebellions do not get a lot of play in history. Very few people even are familiar with the 115 rebellion, which is also called the Kittos rebellion. But if you read the actual texts of the historians, you can see what an existential threat this was to the empire. In the 115 rebellion, the Jews gained military control over the island of Cyprus, and they genocided the entire Gentile population, 240,000.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. They also gained control of Cyrenia, modern-day Libya, which had been an enormous Roman colony, very prosperous, and they depopulated it. They literally got rid of all of the Gentiles. Trajan, or I think it was Hadrian, had to later on try to repopulate this zone because there wasn't anyone left. This rebellion then was able to drive Rome out of Egypt. Now imagine this. This is the Roman breadbasket.
Yeah.
And yet there are actual letters in existence written by the Roman magistrates of Alexandria who are fleeing from the Jews down the Nile, trying to get away from the military activity of the Jews. So they're going down the Nile toward Africa, dark Africa. They're just getting the hell out. The rebellion then got into Asia Minor. Okay, now Trajan steps in and they're trying to control it, and it gets into Judea. They finally got it under control. It's not exactly known when, but say like around 120, they're finally in some kind of military control. But they're so concerned about this this messianic fervor that Rome overpopulates Judea with legions trying to keep everything in control. But it doesn't work. In 133, you now have the Bar Kokhba rebellion. And of course, this Bar Kokhba means son of the star, which is reference to the star prophecy, the messianic prophecy. He gets going. They kick Rome out. They defeat them militarily. They once again, like they did in 66, they set up Eretz Israel, the religious state of the Jews in Israel and inside the boundaries of the land that they believe God gave them. And the battle then that rages is so catastrophic that at the conclusion, the Roman general comes back after he's won militarily and they've driven the Jews out of Judea. This is the beginning of the diaspora.
Yeah.
And the general comes back, and when generals return to Rome, without exception, they give a salutation to Caesar. They come forward and they say, we hope Caesar is well, and if Caesar is well, I am well, and the troops are well. They didn't give the salutation after the Bar Kokhba struggle because they had lost so many sons of people living in Rome that they were afraid the population would rebel. See, so this is what this period, you know, that basically was the motivation for the production of the Gospels, is a complete and all-out genocidal struggle where each side is attempting to exterminate the other, and Rome somehow was able to survive the struggle. Now, you know, this of course is from the Roman perspective, is brought about by this misunderstanding of their divine scriptures. And you see, this is why the Gospels were written, is that the Gospels just take these proof texts, which if you're familiar with the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can see that they had the same proof texts, in other words, the same passages in the Hebrew Bible that they use to justify their belief in the Messiah and the coming of Messiah. Well,
yeah.
Okay, in Christianity, you've got these proof texts being used for a completely different purpose. The Messiah is a pacifist. Okay? Mm-hmm. So this is what they were trying to do, is they're trying to say, look, we have a different way of scriptural interpretation, and we think this is, you know, the right one, and we want you to follow it, and this will lead you to a better place. And of course, it'll also be like a kind of mind control and keep the Roman Empire in place. Well,
yeah.
So when you get to the Shakespearean literature, what you really have is a group, and Emilia Bassano did work with other, can be called Murano or crypto Jews, because
right.
There were, you know, in fact, no real Jews in quotes. These were people whose Jewish identity was kept secret. So what they are doing is they are taking the typology in the Gospels and they are reversing it back to its correct form, in their opinion. You see, so this is really what you're really seeing when you see the Gospels and the Shakespeare stuff, is you're really seeing a intellectual warfare where the messianic prophecies are morphed by Rome and then remorphed by the secret Jewish organization that existed in 16th century Britain. This battle is interesting to look at. I think people who will read the book and can get through my miserable prose will see that the plays themselves are actually quite interesting when you know what they're really talking about. The Shakespeare is it's a kind of really, when you actually start studying, it's sort of interesting. The author used 23,000 words and expressions, right?
Right.
So the Shakespearean vocabulary is just this miracle of genius, so called. But in fact, there's no reason to do this. The plays suffer from this. And it's completely pompous. The next largest vocabulary in the English literature, if my memory serves, would be Milton, and he would be like somewhere between like 8,000 and 9,000 words and expressions. Okay.
Oh boy.
So 23,000 is just absurd, and basically it's just taking the entire encyclopedia and dumping it into literature. Now, what this is, the purpose, though, see, is domination. It's the Romans attempted to perfect the typology. If you look at the typology in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where they have the kind of messianic typology that the Gospels mock and perfect, you've got stuff like the Habakkuk Pesher, which, is this really kind of weak interpretation of Habakkuk, the book, this Old Testament story, and they're trying to overlay the story into the period of time before Christianity. They're trying to find the Messiah, and they've got some kind of analysis, but it's pretty weak, frankly, if you look at it. And so the Romans then, they come up with the typology between Josephus and the Gospels, and here it's just completely perfect. You know, they've got most of the events are absolutely in sequence, and it just hits you over the head. So the Shakespearean stuff is just a response to that, and they're just saying it's a pie in the face to Gentiles, where we've taken the entire English vocabulary. We didn't have to just do what the Romans did. You know, we've done everything here. But what this does is it shows you that Shakespeare is actually a pseudo genius. Shakespeare has just been constructed to have the appearance of a genius, so that basically because they knew at some point the Gospels would be understood. And when that happened, they wanted to make sure that the Jewish pie in the face response would be able to be delivered. So even the name of the character, Shakespeare, in the first folio, you have the name is Will Shakespeare, and there's a hyphen between Shake and Spear. And you can see that the name is just a pun. It's a martial declaration indicating that the Jews have not been crushed by Roman Catholicism, but in fact are continuing to and will shake the
spear. Yeah.
Right. So, but you know, the problem with the Shakespearean literature, it's the same problem that I have with the Gospels. I mean, it's a genocidal humor, which I don't think ultimately is beneficial for us to engage in.
Yeah.
You see cryptic references to Shakespeare, which suggest to me that many people are aware of the humor, just as though I think there are people who are aware of humor in the Gospels. And so this then gets into, the ugly world of secret societies and the paranoia of like, well, who knows what and what's being kept.
Yeah. Let me ask a couple of things before we proceed on that train there of thought. Yeah. So it's basically taken 1500 years later in the process that we're seeing something come out of the, why did it take so long? I mean, my question here is a little bit more about the motives of Bassano, or rather maybe she was picked. Maybe she didn't even do it all on her own, kind of what already has been speculated about concerning Shakespeare, because is she carrying this load and understanding of the Gospels on her own shoulders, and then later decides to on her own do anything about it? This seems more like an organized attempt, correct?
Yeah, it's completely organized. And the motivation actually comes through Christopher Marlowe, who was her lover and I think a crypto Jew. He was this goes into some, these technical aspects of Bassano's life, which those who read the book will get lots of this. But in general, Bassano became Marlowe's mistress during the time when she was the official mistress of a muckamuck in the Elizabethan court, the Henry Hudson, who was the owner of the Globe Theater, which was how she had access to, having her plays put on. Marlowe's death is really the critical point where her literature gets launched. And this is covered in the plays, which is something that has not ever been understood, but is fairly easy to decode once you've got the right understanding. Marlowe wrote a book, which has been lost, unfortunately, that pointed out that the Gospels had been written by a single man, and he would have been indicating Josephus. He wrote a whole book about it. This book is recorded in letters, and it's also in the same letters, it's recorded that such a dangerous voice to Christianity needs to be silenced, okay? Marlowe then, within weeks of this, had his unfortunate murder, where basically these were family members of the council privy, this sort of secret police force that existed in Elizabethan England that mattered, that dominated matters of theology and stuff. And they arranged to have Marlowe killed. Now, what's interesting is that then Bassano documented this, and this I'll just go into this in a little depth because I think this might be of some interest to your readers, is that in The Merry Wives of Windsor, she basically links to the official coroner's inquest that about Marlowe's death, which had been lost to history, but amazingly was rediscovered a few years ago and published. And in that, described that there was this bill, the reckoning that Marlowe had been murdered regarding. And so in The Merry Wives of Windsor, you have this kind of Shakespearean prose where Shallow, Slender, and I believe Hugh Evans are all chatting about. And they describe some kind of legal situation that needs some clarification. And Shakespeare, she invents a couple words, a custelrorum and rattlelorum. And these are basically plays on a fancy Latin word, which means a keeper of legal records. And so then she goes on and she talks, kind of just takes off into a little strange tangent, don't really kind of make much sense about it. But she starts talking about the Privy Council. She starts talking about the council's activity and how cruel it can be. And then she starts talking about a greyhound. She says, "You know, you're a follow greyhound. I heard he was outrun at the Cotstall." This is an act, I believe, Act One, Scene. Gosh, I can't recall, but. It's Shakespearean aficionados have no trouble finding it because it's one of these things. It's one of these Shakespearean puzzles. No one has any idea. just give me 10 seconds.
Sure.
Here we go. So it goes, he says, "How does your fallow greyhound, sir? I heard he was outrun on Cotstall. It could not be judged, sir. You'll not confess. That he will not. Tis your fault. Tis a good dog. A cur, sir. Sir, he's a good dog and a fair dog. There can be more said. He's a good and fair." Now, you see, Marlowe was fallow. He was kind of sandy hair, and he was nicknamed the Greyhound. He was killed on the Cotstall, May 1st. That's a particular day of religious celebration. And when she says, you know, you'll not confess, it could not be judged. This is just cryptic language, just saying that, you know, we know that he didn't think on us and report us to the authorities, that he permitted himself probably to be tortured and died without giving up the information. So then she goes on talking about the Privy Council and so, you know, it's kind of interesting and vague, but then she breaks into clarification of the whole thing because she starts quoting from Marlowe's poem. See, at this point, now who the identification of the greyhound that was outrun at the Cotstall, there's no more confusion because they start actually singing Marlowe's poem from the passionate shepherd to his love, where, you know, it says, "I will make thee a bed of roses and 1,000 fragrant posies." And in Shakespeare, it starts out, "To shallow river, to whom falls, melodious birds sing madrigals. We will make our bed of roses and 1,000 fragrant posies." She now transmogrifies the whole literature and she breaks into Sitting by the Babylon, which is the beginning of Psalm 137. Now, Psalm 137 is a critical piece of literature for understanding Shakespeare. And the first thing is that you should recognize that Shakespeare quotes the Psalms 137 times. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Psalm 137 is the fiercest piece of Hebrew revenge literature in the Bible. It's the psalm which describes the daughters of Babylon, happy we shall be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy he shall be that taketh and dashes the, you know, the children of Babylon against the rocks.
Right. Yep. Right.
So now Shakespeare quotes the Psalms 137 times, and here she is using it as her method of illustrating Marlowe's death. Right.
Right.
So you now have an understanding of really what motivates this whole literature we call Shakespeare. Without this particular little passage understanding, you're not really going to get very far.
Is this way over the top complicated, or is it easily enough for anybody to understand who
anybody can get it. It's really not that tough. It's
right.
I mean, some of the stuff is complicated, but just the general framework is I think pretty straightforward. Most people that I've actually showed it to don't have any trouble. It's
again, the reason why I'm asking that is because, of course, again, for the purposes of someone also discovering this in the works, right, that people can recognize and see, aha, I see what they're getting at, right? Because you would want to have a certain effect achieved, I guess, as well. Otherwise, why write it, correct?
Right. Well, I mean, her point is very simple. She's just saying, look, if you understand the typology of the gospel, you get the fact that this is Roman humor and the Jews are being mocked as having a human Passover lamb, right?
Yeah.
I mean, looking at, you know, Roman Catholicism, the whole symbolism is concerning the new covenant. And this is all set off by the story about the sacrifice of the new Passover lamb, Jesus Christ. He's designated specifically using typology as a human Passover lamb. And when you actually kind of get the connection between the Josephus work and the Gospels, you can see that the human Passover lamb isn't symbolic. They're eating the guy. It's a cannibal joke, right?
Yeah.
So now when you bring that perspective to the Shakespearean literature, it's supposed to be comprehensible. You know, it's a little tough because there's like fancy words and whatnot, and she goes out of her way to, you know, with the 23,000 words and expressions, you know, you might, you know, it's like, what the heck is a person talking about? I would say that almost anyone with the right perspective can immediately recognize like Titus Andronicus as a spoof of the Gospels.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, I just, frankly, I'm not sure really what value the Shakespearean literature has. I kind of have the same feeling about the Gospels. I don't think this literature is useful. I don't think it makes better people to read it.
Right.
And I don't think, I mean, I would compare it very much to the apocalyptic zombie cannibalism in our current, genre.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's sick.
Now, I've always wondered, Joseph, why it is that Shakespeare has been pushed in the way it has and just this incredible praising around it. And a part of me has always been, well, some of it must be that the complexion, as you said, because of the usage of so many variables in language and everything else, has kind of been attributed to the non-understanding of it. It's kind of the same way when some people look at some modern art. They don't really understand what they're looking at, but they're loving it because their neurons are firing. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if Shakespeare hadn't been promoted by the organization that had produced the literature or assisted her in the production, who I think is very much involved in the arts and whatnot, I think that this stuff would have just been forgotten years ago because, frankly, it's crap. I mean, Romeo and Juliet, what's that about? You know, she meets a guy and then 3 days later, you know, she wakes up and he dies. I mean, it's just the plots are stupid. The language is flowery, but incomprehensible quite often. The way it's been promoted just because it makes people who know kind of the inside joke, they laugh, you know, and so that's it's mockery. Why were the Gospels so popular? Why did the Christianity, you know, end up as the state religion? Well, it became the state religion not because of any power of Jesus. It was because the power of Caesar and his organization promoted it and demanded it.
That's right.
So with the Shakespeare stuff, I would say the first, you know, candidate to explain its long-standing, connection to culture is that it's the same thing. We're just looking at the same thing, except this is just the second version of it
updated. Very interesting. Yep. Now, as far as tactic goes, let's just talk about this a little bit more. There must be other levels where this is important to control the dialogue, to control the meme, if we look at the work, so there's a lot of history weaved into it, a lot of, you know, European sure. courts and everything else are described and talked about. I mean, I guess to ask the question, why is it important to have plays like this, would be equally stupid as to ask, why is it important to control the movie and entertainment industry, I guess, right?
Sure, but I mean, if you kind of have a grasp of the literature, the meaning of literature, this stuff sort of clears up and doesn't create too much confusion. I mean, if you read Josephus, The Wars of the Jews, this, you know, the basis for the Jesus story typology. At the end of it, Eleazar is, he gives this long speech, which says, look, God has gone over to the Romans and the best thing for us to do is to kill ourselves, basically, right? So Eleazar is representing the Jewish Messiah, and he's telling them that the best thing to do is to kill ourselves. Now, I would say this is an example of very primitive mind control. This is essentially a Roman effort to get the Jewish messianic rebels to think that suicide is a good idea, which Rome, frankly, would have loved to have promoted.
Right.
Now, when you come to the Shakespearean stuff, you know, and you have, you know, is it better, you know, to live or die, you know, Hamlet's bit. I mean, this is just a repetition of the same theme. See?
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's no hocus pocus. Once you have the interpretive framework understood, it's absolutely clear. You know, is it the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune to better to endure them? You know, of course it's not. But they're just this is an author who is aware of the Roman mind control attempts and is now mocking it in reverse. And so, you know, when you come to like Romeo and Juliet, which I'll just give because it's so stupid, I'll give an explanation of that story so you can see what we're really dealing with.
Right.
Romeo and Juliet all takes place leading up to Lammastad, which is this archaic Christian feast, which basically is the equivalent of the Passover in the sense that it concerns the consecration of bread, right?
Right.
So, you know, at the end of Romeo and Juliet, you've had this typical Shakespearean bloodbath where like about 80% of the people are now dead in a big pile. And they're all dead, you know. And you've had this odd use of flour throughout the play. You've had the flower of the eye, the people are compared to different flowers or become the flowers, you know, then like people have wondered about this, you know, what the heck's going on? Well, it isn't too hard to figure out that it's a pun when you recognize that this is just kind of a reversing of the, this is my flesh, the bread is my flesh kind of stuff in the Gospels. And
right.
Lammastad is basically they're using Lammastad as the Passover equivalent because of the Passover's connection to the consecration of bread, you know, the unleavened bread. And so all of this stuff about flowers, now it gives you an understanding of what the big pile of corpses is supposed to be, you know, because, of course, Romeo, before he dies, he gets off about 10 cannibalism jokes. You know, he's just talking about how the tomb is just eating human flesh and things. And, you know, so it's grim. But it's pretty obvious, you know, once you kind of get it, the interpretive framework down, you can see what the authors are trying to do and what the humor is, you know?
Yeah. Right.
So that's, you know, and Romeo and Juliet's got, they have this absurd use of Daniel type numbers. Like in the Gospels, you know, there you have Jesus actually just saying that the prophet Daniel is going to come about. And then you've got, like in Josephus, the abomination of desolation, which is where the temple no longer has a sacrifice. And so you have desolation, and this is an abomination because God is not being given his proper sacrifices. Well, it occurs exactly 3.5 years into the war, or from when the Flavians land in Israel. And scholars have noticed this. They go, gee, this is looks kind of fishy, because it's like 3.5 years in, and Daniel had talked about the abomination of desolation occurring at the midpoint of a week, and a week is 7 years. So the fact that Josephus recorded this thing 3.5 years after the Flavians showed up to fight sure looks fishy, sure looks like fake dates. And so then in Romeo and Juliet, Juliet sleeps for 42 hours because this is a divisible of seven, and she's predicted to fall down and die at the midpoint of a week, 11 years from a certain point earlier in the play. And the author is just reversing the goofing off of Daniel, but this time to show that it's an apocalypse for the Gentile, not
right.
for the Jew.
Exactly. Now, so this is obviously have you tracked down when actually the major push for Shakespeare's work started to kick in? I mean, it hasn't been since the foundation of it, right? This is more in modern times, correct?
It's much more the case. And I haven't spent actually any time at all looking at that. I've wondered about it and want to. I pick up from time to time things that kind of will enable me, when I have enough time to go into it, try to trace this back up. If anyone has the video of the modern film rendition of Titus Andronicus, look at it and look at the ending. If you see have read my interpretation, you'll see that the child that in the play is left with the royal family. This is a reversing of what the Gospels do, whereby they slip a Roman Caesar in to the Jewish royal family as Caesar. So here you've got a son of Aaron, and Aaron, of course, is the family of the Maccabees, which would have been the royal family that the Gospels are making fun of. So here the family of Aaron strikes back, and they leave a child with the royal family. And in the play, this is just a one-line, sort of nothing comment that doesn't really make a whole lot of difference in the play. And then the play goes on and has a whole bunch of other stuff, and it concludes. Well, in the current movie version, which I got because I just wanted to see the film in a visual adaptation, they just completely change the ending, just arbitrarily change it so that the Gentile character with his bright blonde hair is carrying this child of Aaron, who's, dark-skinned, a Moor, basically, would be the aphorism that the Shakespearean literature uses.
Right.
And they're carrying it into the sun. And the entire ending is gone, and all you have is this image of that. Now, as I saw it, there's only one real way to understand that, which is that whoever produced the play, and the director was Julie Taymor, had an understanding of the actual typological level of Shakespeare, because
right.
you
yep.
wouldn't have just selected this ending. And she gave she was asked about it. I was curious about this, so I Googled it and came up with the fact that she had been asked about, well, why the heck did you change you're completely faithful to the entire play, and then at the very end you just changed everything. How come? And she said, it just made sense to us. Well, I don't buy that. That makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
I think that she actually has an understanding and wanted to make a representation, an homage to the real literature and the real author.
Right. Wow. Well, very interesting. I remember seeing that a while back, and I have to rewatch some of that again, because that, of course, puts a completely different spin on things here. What now, is there a reasoning here behind, what you've done is basically shown that there are values in the Old Testament as belonging to the Jewish people at the time. The New Testament comes along. It's a Roman. Well, as we've talked about before, Flavius, of course, was Jewish himself. He worked together with the Romans. There seems to be more of a collaboration there. But nonetheless, there is a kind of a tainting of the whole message coming out of what later is the Bible, with the New Testament, with the Gospels coming on later. So the question here is there an innate antagonism to what was created during this time with the Romans? And is this something that has consequently been carried forward into the modern world? I mean, if we look at the innate antagonism towards European societies here, one can't help to wonder, right?
Well, I mean, first, I think most, in terms of this struggle, I mean, yes, of course, that struggle is in existence, and I would say that Gentiles do not understand the actual framework that many Jews who are influenced by their history and by the Old Testament have. Now, of course, we have the Holocaust as kind of a motivating framework. We can understand that this is this terrible thing which creates a certain perspective of Gentiles and Jews. But long before this, you have if you look in the Talmud, you'll see that basically the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, had tremendous influence. And this was way before World War II, World War I. The Torah basically has both slavery and genocide as acceptable. Slavery of Gentiles and genocide of Gentiles as acceptables in certain contexts. This is an issue that I would think needs just a lot more analysis, particularly by Gentiles. So often they're accused of anti-Semitism if they try to bring some kind of criticism in a general sense against Jews, and so often it is anti-Semitism. It's just irrational. But there are other times when you'd want to do more analysis. I mean, in the United States, I think that something as important as the Federal Reserve being just chronically run by Jewish individuals seems undemocratic.
Sure, yeah. In times of diversity and affirmative action and everything else, right? Where are we,
Here we are in affirmative action, where you have mandated racial participation, and somehow you can never get a Gentile to run the darn thing, which is basically the whole mainspring of our economy. So this just doesn't smell good to me, and I would like to see it analyzed. I would like to see the process by which these individuals are vetted, have a component of race in the vetting, so that you don't end up with just one ethnicity basically dominating another, particularly when it's just this tiny minority. What fraction of American population are Jews? Why do they have this sort of influence? So to have a dialogue about this, it seems like you have to crawl over the accusations of anti-Semitism.
Well, that's just that's absolutely absurd. I mean, we've even had an Israeli foreign minister. Sorry to cut you. I just have to mention this.
Go ahead.
Shalomit, I think her first name is Aloni. Anyway, she talked about on Democracy Now about this, and basically talking about the Holocaust card, the anti-Semitic card. That basically any time Israel or there's questioning of Jewish people, they always, she used these words, we always use anti-Semitism the trick or use the Holocaust card to kind of stifle any kind of criticism of it. This is just, I mean, this is absurd, and people have to just get over that, you know, because...
Yeah, you know, but the thing is they won't, because there isn't the process in place for them to do so. And, you know, you have to hand it to Jewish media moguls and influencers, because, you know, if I was in their place, I'd probably do the same thing. They want to promote their interests, and so their position inside the media is available to help them do that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with this. In fact, this just seems to me to be normal human nature. The problem is that they are simply too effective, and that the Gentiles never have a response to it, because there would be, in my opinion, a more democratic and fairer society if this particular subject could be talked about. And people could, I think, just as one obvious example, you'd have a different process to create the heads of the Federal Reserve in the United States. And I also think that if you started, you know, talking about it, the one thing that would immediately become clear is that you have too much underrepresentation of Gentiles in terms of the media.
Right. Yeah.
You know, where is the Gentile media that promotes our interests in the same way that Jewish media people are able to promote their interests?
Well, so we're European, so we can't have interests, because then that's racism. So.
Yeah, and then that's, and see, this is it. This is the entire thing. And so this has just been, you know, it's very clever how they've been able to do this. And it hasn't really led to a good world for the Gentiles. And, you know, I was doing like Caesar's Messiah promotion, and I was at a venue with a Jewish scholar, and we were talking about the Middle East and the context of the Caesar's Messiah. And this individual was supporting my work in general, but he was also saying that, you know, we can see, you know, since we know now the truth of Christianity, that that the foreign policy in the Middle East is correct. Somehow he was, you know, linking to this. And when someone questioned him, he went into a defense of it based on the Holocaust.
Wow.
You know, and so my thought was, well, you know, it's really interesting to me. You know, the number came up, the 6 million number, right?
Yep.
How many Jews had died.
Sure.
And so I said, well, you know, the 20th century actually had another Holocaust, which was the Holocaust of the Gentile. And I said, how many people died in wars and war-related events during the 20th century of
Virginia? Yeah, my God.
Oof. And, you know, what's really interesting, Henrik, is that if you try to get this number, it's impossible. I mean, it is so vast. 200 million, 100 million, 220.
Yeah,
I mean, the numbers are so gigantic that rounding errors are like 20 million.
Yep, yep.
You look at like the Ukrainian, what do they call it? The
Holodomor.
Right. Yeah, and so you try to get some statistics on that, you know. Was it 10 million? Was it 25 million? No one even knows.
Yeah.
No one counted these bodies. And so I said, well, you know, okay, now in terms of the Middle East, I got into a kind of a you know, little intellectual scuffle with this guy. I said, you know, here's the problem, is that I fully recognize why this makes sense to your perspective, why our Middle East, you know, how this works for you, because you have nothing but the Holocaust as your perspective. But my problem is, I have the Holocaust of the Gentile as my perspective.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at 200, I mean, you know, like 175 million, a big number, much bigger than your Holocaust, by the way, not to, you know, have a Holocaust size contest, but we had this problem, which, you see, we get wiped out by bad political leadership.
Sure, yeah.
Same way, same kind of thing happened to you, except in your case, you know, you say, well, they rounded us up, you know, and okay, you know, I'm all ears on that one. The problem is, we also got Holocausted, and when you start arbitrarily talking about, you know, changing the regimes of unfriendly to Israel nations in the Middle East, and you end up with European soldiers in there taking these casualties, then this is like my Holocaust is being repeated again.
Yeah.
You see, yeah. It's my Holocaust now. It's so we have a competition, which if it is honestly vetted and fair and reasonable people honestly bring these perspectives, I think you end up with a lot less wars. When you let one group dominate and intimidate, right, with you know, rate charges of racism or something as penetrating as anti-Semitism, then how fair is and how meaningful is the discussion? You see, you don't start bringing in all the other ideas and all of the different things that could, in fact, create diplomacy. Because if you only have the stick, which comes from the emotional energy of the Holocaust, then you aren't naturally going to move into these areas which could produce diplomacy. Because, you see, I don't think that any human is lacking in the capacity for reason and self-interest. And so, you know, my question to him was, well, where is the diplomacy between the West and the Islamic world?
Right.
To try to, through diplomacy, bring about the correct changes rather than just the brutal stick, which always ends up with my problem occurring.
Yeah.
The Holocaust of the Gentile. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen this, Henrik, but the statistics on the number of people who are serving in U.S. Forces overseas that are on drugs, that are on these psychotropic drugs.
Right.
And then the number who have this, you know, post-traumatic syndrome that are treated with drugs. Again, this is like the Holocaust of the 20th century. I can't get the data. It's just some huge number. It's just so large. It's a national scandal, and yet it's never really discussed. But you see, to me, this is just another component of the Gentile Holocaust. All of these kids, and that's really most of them are, they're in their early 20s, who come back and have to have these drugs.
Yeah.
This is something that should be a component in the discussion of where is our diplomacy to avoid war.
Yeah.
But I don't see it. You see, and so this is. You know, this is sorry to be long-winded, but this is just, you know, how I when I'm and you can imagine I'm constantly being confronted with these issues.
Sure. Yeah.
This, my position is that, you look at our literature and it's just full of hatred, racial hatred and genocide, cannibalism. Just it's atrocious. OK, how do we make it right? How do we get it better? If we don't bring the intellect into our equation, and then we'll never make any progress. And it has to be done on a basis where everyone gets to have their interests represented. So a lot of work to do, brother.
Oh yeah, I know. This is a very important topic here, Joseph, and I want to pick this right up after the break and continue talking more about this and try to kind of put this in perspective as well. And talk about the lack of distribution within so everything that's being touted today in terms of fairness and equality and everything is everything but right the majority is the non-protected group now in some cases, and soon enough we won't even be the majority in some of the countries that we've been in for thousands and thousands of years. But we'll talk more about that after the break. There's so many more points I want to wing by you and much more to discuss about this. Let's just kind of give out some of the details here as well, because the main topic here so far that we talked about is, of course, the new book, Shakespeare's Messiah and A Secret Messiah. Sorry, and let's give out some details about that and where people can buy the book,
sure,
Joseph.
Well, it's basically it's an internet phenomena. You can get it, Amazon, but I would prefer people to go to my website, caesarsmessiah.com. Or the new website, InsideOutAsylum.com, which will be the place that I'll basically be doing discussions about the new book. But those Those sites have the book available, and I think people will find it kind of an interesting read. So,
well, absolutely. Exactly. There's a lot of good stuff in there. We've only kind of really scraped the surface here so far as well, and much more is coming up. But in the meantime, then, the website's insideoutasylum.com and also caesarsmessiah.com. We'll have these linked up. Much more to come. Ladies and gentlemen, please stay with us. More with Joseph Atwill is coming after the break.